In looking at his life, as I understand it, as I've come to learn a bit more about it since I had access to the files, and also doing some more research, things come to me, and someone wrote to me a couple of years ago, said he grew up in the same block as Cohen, said that everyone on that block worked for a man called Tibor Rosenbaum. The Cohens, the next day, the Bacalls next door, and a whole bunch of people on this block in downtown Westmount, which is in the center of Montreal on a mountain, right, elite neighborhood. Everyone, and they're all Jewish, essentially, in that block. They all worked for Tibor Rosenbaum. Rosenbaum was the head of a company called Permindex. He was an arms dealer. He was involved in human trafficking and drug trafficking. That's what Permindex was all about. But it was also a money laundering operation. And the Bronfman family, who are the kingpins of Canadian crime, but also high up in government, they really run our government, they were some of the main players. So was Alan Dulles of the CIA on the board of Permindex. So so people in the Italian mafia and the Italian P2 Lodge, and people in New Orleans, including Clay Shaw, who was the only person ever arrested for conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy. They were involved in the Kennedy assassination, among other things. Major global organized crime. Now, everyone on Cohen's block worked for him. Tibor Rosenbaum being the man in Switzerland. He had an associate in Montreal called Louis Bloomfield, partnered with Cohen's mother's cousin's law firm, Phillips, Bloomfield, Phillips, Feinberg. Anyway, it went through different incarnations over the years. So the Cohen family and their relatives in that neighborhood, but also global outside Montreal, can be directly linked to the Kennedy assassination and to huge assassinations, money laundering, global organized crime, drugs, human trafficking, etc. They're in on it. Now, who is Cohen's father? I have a feeling he was a good guy. He was all right. The mother, I think she was connected to criminals. This is my view. Cohen is born into that family. He's 8 years old. His father dies. He's got an older sister. At the funeral, the uncles come around, and this is in his papers too, but I knew this is what would happen. I always knew this is what happened. They all cluster around and say, well, you're the man of the family now. You've got to take care of your mother and sister. And for his entire life, that's what he took on. And essentially what was offered to him were chances to succeed in the family business, which he didn't want. But the family business really was connected to organized crime on a very high level, including people in the Senate and, you know, the courts and so on in Ontario and Quebec. And that's what he fell into. Then he went to McGill, where he met people who were Fabian socialists, who, like his mentors, F.R. Scott, and all of that. If you know what to look for, you can find in the documents. Mm-hmm. Much of it he wrote about in different ways. So if anyone really wanted to, I'm sure I'm not the first. They could make a case for him having been born into a powerful, you know, and I think they were also involved in a cult. That's what I was told. I've been told that more than once, but was probably Sabotage V, that, you know, that strain of Kabbalah and journalism, and they're the same people that basically run Hollywood.
Did you say Kabbalah and journalism?
Judaism. You know,
Judaism.
He wasn't really Jewish. He was a Freemason and he was a Kabbalist and he was way too sophisticated. I mean, to be just a Jewish guy from Montreal with a little yarmulke, you know, he would put that on, but he'd go to synagogue and so on. But he didn't have those beliefs. He had essentially had Masonic and Sabbatean beliefs. I know that just because from talking with him,
mm-hmm.
meeting him. I mean, you know, so that's a whole, you know, it's like a whole complex of things you can dig into.
Mm-hmm.
You find all kinds of connections and proof. Well, I don't know. You know, I'm in the process of... Do you think I can do that? I don't think so. I don't think I have the skills, you know, the training to really... I mean, Lyndon LaRouche did it, you know, with a team of 30 people or something, 30 researchers, and he put together a file on Permindex back in the 70s and published this book called Dope Inc., you know, and I mean, but that's, you know, a team of 30 people or something. I don't know how many researchers he had a lot of people
mm-hmm.
going through everything. Well, I'm not going to do that. But I can wake up, I wake myself up by reading that stuff and by then applying it to things that I do have some experience of, which are, you know, just kind of local, the local scene here and the things he said to me and the things I saw and the things that didn't make sense and the world that he obviously moved in. Because he would phone me up and I'd go over to his place. I wouldn't know why. He'd be putting on his hat, get in front of the mirror, putting on his hat and going out somewhere. Personally, I think, you know, and then he'd be gone. What's that all about? You know, just to say hi and then, well. But I think he used me as a sort of a lucky charm mascot because I had an earlier, you know, because of our earlier connection, which went way back into my childhood and the Allen Memorial. And, you know, figuring all this out, this is what I work on. It's personal. It's very... And I don't think it's not fiction, because I don't make anything up.
Mm-hmm.
So, but to, you know, to see how when I do this research on a mega scale, on a mass, you know, a meta scale, like larger scale, how all of it just sort of ends up funneling right into something I can say, well, I saw that, I heard that, he told me that.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I work.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, my concern, I suppose, is not so much about your own process, though. I think that's an interesting area of discussion in itself, like how arranging the facts and discovering the facts does bring us towards wholeness and healing. I mean, that really is essential to what I think we're both doing, and that's partly why...
Cause and effect, always trying to find causes.
Yeah, and identifying the causes and therefore understanding the effects, right? So I think we more or less agree there, even if we don't agree about the methods. The other thing is that I guess I'm more sensitive to the what I call the second matrix and the whole conspiratainment field out there, which is basically... it's all internet-based, so you say, well, you would write this in a book. You wouldn't write this in a book, but you'd write it on a blog. Well, there's countless blogs that report stuff that is just made up, or it's not, you know, it's not fact-checked and all the rest of it, and people don't care. And specifically around the subjects we're talking about, there's just a massive wealth of poor information that I would say is actually disinformation that's being generated by intelligence agencies, by groups deliberately in order to obfuscate, in order to muddy the waters, so that we can't really tell the difference between, you know, made up or exaggerated stories and the real stuff. And I noticed this is when I was looking into what's going on in Hollywood yesterday, that I found... I did a Google search for Hollywood pedophilia because I thought, my God, it's really coming to light now. Like, there's all these YouTube videos, and I saw Justin Bieber. He also said that the music industry is run by pedophiles. I'm like, what the fuck? Is this really coming to light now? So I did a Google search. The first hit to come up was Brad Pitt says that Hollywood's run by pedophiles. I went to it. It was Neon Nexus or something like Neon Nettle or whatever. Yeah. And it seemed to be a legitimate article, photo of Brad Pitt with this quote about, you've heard of the Illuminati, right? Well, that Hollywood is run by pedophiles, blah, 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 June 2017. So I was like, how's that possible? Like, that didn't get picked up. So then, of course, you go to Snopes and they say that this is false, this is bullshit. And it probably is, because, you know, if Brad Pitt really said it, then, you know, he would come out and say it again, right? He wouldn't just do it once. So, I mean... one of the net results of this is that it's getting harder and harder to tell the difference between fake news, to use the, you know, the jargon, and actual reporting or genuine testimony, such as Corey Feldman or the stuff about Kevin Spacey. We know that's real in quotes, because I have to put it in quotes because you never know how much is being manufactured at a deeper level. But anyway, it's official. It's official news because it's picked up by all the others, but then and it's being acted on, right?
So, but I'm not in favor of it, you know.
You're not in favor of it.
I'm not in favor of singling out certain people and having, and I do think that's a kind of a witch hunt, and then have everybody focus all their energy on,
it's,
you know.
It's not a witch hunt, it's scapegoating. It's scapegoating. It's very different from witch hunting. The idea of witch hunting is you're hunting for people who don't exist. Right, so there's never been a witch hunt in the whole history of the world, probably. I mean, even the witches were real, but certainly when they talk about, you know, identifying pedophiles as a witch hunt, that's got to be a misnomer, because it seems like they do exist. But with Spacey, scapegoating, that's a way, that's damage control. But as we were saying about Cohen and DeRuta, there's more than one reason for identifying crimes or misbehaviors. It isn't just about holding the person accountable, or I think that is part of it. I mean, you're not saying that Spacey should just be given a free pass, I presume.
No, absolutely not. But, I mean, I think about that all the time, what you just talked about. I mean, I have posted fake news articles. People said that's fake. I say, okay. But the principle of it is true, like the Brad Pitt thing. I shared that on Facebook. Then I realized it was fake. Mm-hmm. But I don't really, at the same time, I know the principle's true. And I think when that came out, I had a feeling more and more of this is going to be coming out. And it's going to be found out to be true. And for all I know, Brad Pitt did say that to someone off the record, and they phoned it in, and somebody at Neon Nettle decided to write an article around it, and that's sleazy journalism, but it may be based on something that actually happened. And plus, we know that I've known for years pedophilia, long before the scandal. Haven't we all known that? I mean, we knew about Jimmy Savile, but I knew it back when I knew Leonard.
Yeah.
I knew it in 1980 when I saw... You know, so I saw him being taken over by this pedophile gang. I could see it then. I just didn't have a name for it. I didn't understand the nature of the system and the rest of it, but I saw signs of it. I was very upset. That's what ruined everything.
Yeah.
Was I picking up on pedophilia. Yeah. So he then was being blackmailed. He was then afraid that I would blackmail him and that, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't play those kinds of games. I just watch, you know, and absorb, and I, you know, I'm a little slow, you know, really, in some ways. So the fact is, though, it's real. Now, I don't believe that scapegoating is the answer, because I think that's just how the powers that be preserve their own position. They use scapegoats. So I see that happening to Kevin Spacey. That's the first thing I think of, is somebody's decided, you know, to throw him and Harvey Weinstein under the bus, because there's even worse people that have to protect themselves. So that's the first thing I think, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, I'm glad that it's coming out. I just don't know that the public has the ability to take in the enormity of it. I think that's the problem. That's always been my problem, is at some point, I just dissociate. Mm-hmm. I just blank out. I cannot deal with, you know. And so I'm working on that. And I think the best approach is to, again, the same thing. It's to focus on the bigger picture and why no one has a choice. Well, yet they do. You have a choice, you know. You have a choice to... Say pirates are taking over your ship, and you know you have a choice to throw yourself overboard and drown, or you know you have choices like that. You can commit suicide rather than execute some other person. You know, we always have those kinds of extreme choices, but you know in truth most people will choose self-preservation, and that's the big weakness people have, is they, you know, Right? So, but if we can get over those, it's the fear, you know? So begin to see how everyone is a victim of the system. I know it's a cliche, and everyone's faced with impossible choices. If they try to advance in the system, they will be offered impossible choices. You can dissolve yourself and make yourself into a nobody, and that's how I would rather go about things. But if you want success and all the things that are supposed to be available to us, you're going to have to probably at some point you're going to end up having to harm someone else just to defend yourself.
Well, you know what it's reminding me of? It's reminding me of how they pushed tobacco through advertising and everything else. They got women smoking tobacco and so on and so forth. They even had to use feminism for that and so on anyway. But anyway, they turned tobacco into a massive industry, got everybody hooked, and then they told us, well, actually it kills you and you need to stop, right? So that's a great way to really fragment people. You get them addicted to something, and then you tell them it's bad for them, and it's too late. They can't just stop doing it. They're already addicted. It seems like something similar on a larger scale here, in terms of they've. We live in a culture in which we're conditioned from birth to want to be a somebody. And now, over time, it's being revealed to us that the drive to be a somebody, well, as you put it, will drive us into impossible choices, and cause us to basically have to shut down our own capacity for compassion and to be human beings and all the rest of it. So really, like the worst possible choice that we could make would be to try and succeed in this system, much worse than taking up smoking. But we're not going to be able to quit. Just because we're being told, or just because we're finding out how pernicious it is, people are still going to be driven to achieve success in the system, even as they discover, the cost of pursuing those goals.
Well, yeah, I mean, the system at some point, I don't know when it happened. Maybe it happened thousands of years ago, or maybe it happened only like in the last 100 years. But yeah, these are the kinds of, well, psychology has really focused on putting people in double bind situations. So that's impossible choices. Well, the Nazis were experts at that, And I guess it go, and maybe the Tavistock Institute also. Well, they did, So Gregory Bateson wrote about the double bind because it was something they intended to use on people to control people, and it does control people. It's basically, self-destruction versus, destruction of some of others. But I do think the core of it is ritual abuse, and I think and going back to Leonard Cohen. It's come to me also just fairly clearly just yesterday I realized, well, the way to understand Leonard is to really study how ritual abuse operates, because I think he was exposed to ritual abuse from his earliest days, earliest childhood, and he developed a personality to deal with it. And one of his biggest traits, people don't talk about that so much now, but they did in the They did back when he first reviewers would say that he seems to he would he was very passive. He was very compliant, and he completely believed in obeying orders and going along with authority. And that was, in knowing him, that was one of the things I most that most bothered me about him, was that you could see it. It was a knee-jerk reaction in him. If there was a conflict, if a conflict popped up in front of him, like a somebody in the parking lot, what happened? Anyway, something about parking his car, and they charged him too much for the parking ticket. His reaction to that was complete. He would completely cave in and surrender, and look hurt, but do what he was told. And he was built that way. That was one of his huge failings, in my opinion, because he never fought back. And I think he was conditioned to be that way. It made him very angry. It gave him a vast amount of passive-aggressive anger that he took out on other people. And I think also helped to fragment him. I think he was really, a very angry person. But he would never, ever allow anger to be expressed in his presence. If you expressed anger or tried to talk about your anger, He would shut you down in a second and pretend that it wasn't happening. So it's, I believe that that's, the, you know, in the end, it's back to the same system we live under to varying degrees, because not all of us buy 100% into it, you know? I mean, I don't feel that I was raised in quite the same... I don't believe I was raised in a world of abuse to the extent that I believe he was. I think he witnessed abuse all the time. I don't believe that my family environment really was based on abuse. It was, we had other values, you know, and one of them was honesty and a few things that we did that we were all right about, you know. But I think if you're born into a crime family, if you're born in, or, you know, a crime family that's become very respectable, you will learn all these triggers and methods and so on. And I think that's what is thrown at us now, and our whole culture has really now become based on that. And that's what we have to change. We have to become aware of that.
Yeah, well, I could see, you could see how the compliance would have its flip side of persecution. Like, if we're conditioned or programmed to comply when we're in the presence of power, then, as you say, that leads to a lot of suppressed rage, and then we seek out targets to persecute. But then that's also a form of compliance to power, because they need to create persecutors.
Right. Well, it's just a system of masters and slaves, or sadomasochism. Well, and then look at Hollywood and look at what, you know, it's all very visible now. That's essentially what human life is being depicted as, right? Cool. When you turn on the television, you're seeing sadomasochism, you're seeing, you know, horrible, abusive, you know, violent, constant violence, people resorting. Because that's part of the game, is to that's the conditioning. They want everyone to believe there's no other system. So it's, you know, it's a satanic culture, as Henry Mackow says. So he's right.
Yeah, well, I prefer not to use the term satanic, as you know, because I think it's another of those things that triggers people, and then, and you know.
You could, it's not Christ-like, you know, because, you know, and so what's the opposite of it, you know? It's that materialistic me versus you.
Sure, you know? Yeah, and I'm not saying it's not a technically accurate term, but it's not, or it can be, but it's not defined. We haven't defined what we mean by it. So, yeah. And you know, bringing it back to this larger question we're talking about Hollywood and the fake news and all that, I think it serves people's interest. It serves the satanic elite's interest to be thought of as satanic elite. Like, they've created a reality tunnel in which they're invisible. That's the main one. That's the mainstream. But then they've created a second reality tunnel for people who aren't, you know, believing the first one and beginning to see the cracks in the first one, in which they are the satanic elite who controls everything. And that reality tunnel is just as much created by those, the ruling class, as the one in the sleeping masses exist in. So if you go to a YouTube video now about Hollywood pedophilia, you might see 500,000 hits, or even 1,000,000. You might see hundreds of comments, and you'll hear people saying, everybody knows that the world is run by Illuminati Satanists now. Yeah. Well, this is hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people. Do you think those people are waking up? Because I don't. I don't think those people are becoming more awake. Because
I suppose that's a way of displacing blame. You know, because in the end, we'll never have access to the, if they exist, we're never going to get access to them. So they might as well not exist.
Well, in a certain sense, except for our own traumas. Now, I mean, the idea of that the ruling class used torture, trauma, and abuse to, you know, create cultural figures and all the rest of it, that has become experientially real to me, to the extent that I've seemed to have followed my own scars inward to some sort of buried affect memory of stuff, and mirroring that, have found enough actual facts, solid evidence around my family to support the intuitive affective feeling that something happened to me. You know, it's not enough to persuade, like, somebody couldn't read Occult Yorkshire and say yes, Jason was ritually abused, but they can certainly look at all the evidence I've amassed and say something was going on in his family and the immediate surroundings, right? So there's two things going on there. Like, one, I'm trying to ascertain the extent of my own damage growing up in this culture, and I know that's real because I experience it on a moment-to-moment basis, you know, how dysfunctional I am. And B, I'm actually looking outside of the bigger picture for evidence and finding really compelling evidence. But it doesn't mean I can name and identify the abusers, and I can't even be sure that how organized it is and how overt, you know, the philosophies are. Like, it remains still somewhat amorphous, but that I think is part of its I don't want to say credibility, because maybe you don't like that word, but part of what makes it grounded is that it's being allowed to remain unfinished, as opposed to this finished version of the narrative, which is Illuminati, MKUltra, mind control rules the world. That's a finished narrative. There aren't any question marks in it, really, except what are we going to do about it, which in my opinion is the wrong question.
What are we going to do about it? Well,
yeah. Because there isn't anything to do about it, so I have to interrupt.
Wake up, you're sleeping in there. You called out my demon. You change your mind and count me out. You say I'm too far gone. No one laughs when you shout. At least no one laughs out loud. I know this feeling. You called out my demon. Wake up, you're sleeping in there. You called out my demon.
I just wanted to say, I know that your sense of your background is, I think it is more amorphous than mine, although that's not really 100% true, but I don't think that the perps that you've sort of been feeling around for and trying to, you know, you're trying to determine who was there, who did what, and so on, I don't think they've been exposed to the extent that that here in Montreal is maybe overexposed. We have a narrative here that's a lot more, it is and it isn't, but it's essentially, you know, we've been named over and over again as the hub from MK Ultra in Canada, and the same names and Dr. Cameron, who's, I think, in many ways a bit of a scapegoat, but I also think he was also 100%, you know, a perpetrator and a very, I guess, evil man, or very, he knew exactly what he was doing, and he, you know, a real mastermind. I think he was all those things. But the thing is, it's all been kind of solidified here, and so I can always point to that, because I just have to look out the window, and I can practically point to the castle on the hill, you know, from here. I mean, it's just right in the center. And so it's a bit, it's almost as if I don't feel I have to go, and anyway, I always explain all of that, because it's been explained, you know, to a great extent. But And the names have been named, and the, you know, and the players, and the CIAs, and you can just sort of trace in the documents, some of them anyway, you know, exist, and you can go through them, and it was a particular program that existed for 20 years or something. You know, it was very organized. It was, you know, they wrote memos all the time about what they were doing, but, you know, so I don't know if that makes a difference, but maybe that just means I'll approach these things a bit differently, but
no, well, of course it does. And also, you have a concrete memory of something that happened to you.
Yeah. Plus, I found a poem that Leonard wrote that I think is about me as a child. But, you know, things like that come up. Where at the Allen Memorial, where I'm sleeping under my grandmother's patchwork quilt, and anyway. And I always read that poem. I read that poem years ago, but I never associated myself with it, except it's for Annie, right? They used to call me Annie, but then they had a girlfriend called Anne, and so on. Everybody said, well, that's about her, except that it's about a child who's reciting Mother Goose and Three Little Pigs. And I don't see how that could really be about this very brilliant woman that I used to know, McGill. You know, it just doesn't quite fit. I've come to the conclusion that he actually wrote a poem for me because I think it's come to me, but through intuitive channels, that he saved my life. When I was at the Allen, they were going to kill me. I was 4 years old, and they were electroshocking me, and they were going to do it a second time, and to the heart. And I actually had a physical body memory of that moment, but I've been told also that he's the one that rushed in and stopped them. So, see, this is something I can't prove, we'll never know for sure, but I think it's true, because it would explain everything. It would explain everything about my relationship with him, why he said certain things, why he invited me, basically adopted me as a family member years later when we met. He made me feel like I was like a family member for a while. But, you know, it explains many things, but it's so personal that you can't even say it. You know, and yet it seems to be like the core reality of the whole thing. This is why I've been so tied up with him. This is why I'm still writing about him. This is why, now he's dead, I'm very relieved. Actually, I'm very happy he's dead, because I really strongly feel that he's been released from, you know, from a whole bunch of things that he just didn't have, he lacked the strength of character to break through it. That was his failure. He could have, I think, but he lacked the character to. So he just lived his. He chose to blow it all off, to tell them all to get lost, and he would never follow orders from them again. And he just couldn't do that. So he remained to the very end loyal to the lodge, to the people that controlled him, and he would complain about it, but he'd never do anything about it. And that was just his choice, you know. And here I am now. It's a year later. He's been dead for a year, and Well, you feel him visiting now and then, you know, just sense that he's doing better. And there'll be another lifetime sometime. It won't be the same, it won't be the same set of circumstances. We went through a really dark time after the war. Before we were old enough to even know what was happening to us, we were forced into something. We're now at a point, 70 years later, you might say, after the creation of the CIA, 1947, would be, yeah, a time. Anyway, to count from now, we're 70 years later. Is it 70 or 60? 70, right. We can now start to, I guess it's sevens, you know, goes in sevens, goes in decades. We can now say, okay, we completed that process. We're coming out the other end of it now. We're about ready to, we should be ready to ascend to another plane now where we can actually look down on all this and watch it burning down, which I think it is. And so at this point, I don't even care about fake versus real. I mean, I do, obviously, I do my best to distinguish between what's real and what isn't, but basically, I see it as all one piece. And it's a house of cards and it's falling. And so Kevin Spacey, that was, wasn't that the name of the series? Well,
House of Cards, yeah.
it's collapsing, you know, and let it, and you know, let the whole thing go down. Meanwhile, you know, document everything you can. If that's your job, you can do it.
Well, I think your job of documentation is to distinguish between fake and real, however, so like if it isn't that, I don't see what else it could be, really.
Fog of war. I think that's what we're in right now. So good, yeah, I totally agree with you. I, you know, but at the same time, I think it's the time is coming when it almost won't matter. Like in the past week, well, in the past month, there have been some very serious, I believe, very serious shakedowns and things that are, that it'll never be put back together.
But it might be put
Okay.
together in an even worse configuration.
Well, that's always a possibility. That depends on us, I guess, and depends on people. If humans, if that's their destiny, not to figure things out and just walk down the same old path again, well, they will, you know.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I mean, my only optimism is if oil runs out and basically social structures can't support themselves, and then it's not possible to, maintain these kind of organized abuse structures because they don't have the technology and the fuel to do it. That would be a way to be optimistic for me. But in terms of human beings actually incultured human beings extricating themselves from the culture in order to create a culture-free society and live happily ever after. I just can't. I guess my imagination just doesn't, can't. It can't make that leap.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't expect that to happen, but I can imagine that there's a certain kind of trance we've been living under, that I think will may be about to dissolve. But one part of it is the difference between the left and the right. It's completely, you know, that has just imploded, and suddenly I find I'm on the right. I guess it's just part of life, right? But this is what often happens, but suddenly I'm on the right of everything. But the left is just a disaster, you know. There's so it's just not what I thought would happen. I didn't see this coming, but I think that the there's been a huge amount of, you know, you talk about it a lot, the indoctrination, that the gender stuff, you know, all the stuff that's going on, the mind control. Much of it, I think, was orchestrated from the left, I'm still trying to figure
Oh,
that out.
via the left, I would say, rather than actually coming from them, because it's
Maybe
not, yeah.
attacking some part of our limbic, I don't know, system, though. Maybe it was designed to, you know, turn make us very irrational and whatever. Anyway,
Yeah, I would say that's a fair summation.
the left part of the, you know. Anyway.
Well, they have to be comprehensive, have to cover all the bases, so but essentially I think it's I've just started reading this book called The Ideology of Tyranny, and it's also about the tyranny of ideologies. I think it's going to be a fantastic book. It's by Preparata, and he begins by writing about this, the right and the left being just one ideological apparatus with, you know, with two apparently opposing parts as a way to prevent any real kind of dissidence from emerging, because if you're against one side, you just join the other and vice versa, right? And I think the fundamental, or a fundamental aim here is what you just said, like pushing people into irrational forms of behavior, because if you create an ideological narrative that people will invest their identity, their sense of identity, like Hollywood, like I write about in Seen and Not Seen. But that narrative is basically false, like any other, you know, Hollywood storyline. Then people will be investing in a false reality, and then over time you make the narrative more and more outrageous and absurd and obviously fictional, but they can't disinvest. They can't actually diverge or depart from the narrative. They have to carry on identifying with their role in the narrative, because they've invested their whole sense of who they are in it. And so then they become more and more irrational also, because they have to keep up with the narrative.
Mm.
I think that's what transgender is a good sort of showing on, not just transgender, but the whole identity politics thing. You know. Like all these, left people really used to be the smarter, the more sensitive, the more... they used to be, right?
Definitely. Yeah.
But now they've had, you know, it's like a creeping thing. It's like the lobster in the pot. The temperature just goes up grade by grade, and they don't notice that they're becoming, you know, the tenets of their ideology are becoming more and more precarious and more and more absurd and divorced from reality. But they can't afford to see that, because then the whole thing would, you know, their whole reason for living would come undone, and they'd have to see that they backed the wrong horse.
Yeah, well, I think when it became the mainstream, you know, the left became the mainstream, then people got very lazy. That's one part of it, anyway. They just stopped thinking, and they just believe. They believe and believe and believe, you know. And now that's not enough, but it's a bit late, you know, to catch up.
Mm.
You know, I think for many people it's late in the day just thinking again.
Yeah.
You know.
Belief is never enough, right? It never is. It doesn't matter what you believe. Hey! I guess there is a there's something about believing something we know, which I've come to quite late in life, probably inevitably, that this is the Christian idea of faith. And I always thought that faith was just to do with believing something that you really want to believe, and I think it is for a lot of people. But for myself, I think I've discovered that there's a kind of something that's probably the same as what people call faith, which is believing something that I feel I know in my heart, but intellectually I know I can't know it. Like life after death, like I feel that I know that, but intellectually I know I can't possibly know that because I can't corroborate it. So then I trust what I know, and that's the kind of faith.
Well, I guess we need a few of those things, but that's so general. Believing that, there's other beliefs that are much more dangerous than that.
Well, I mean, that one's pretty dangerous too. I mean, it's
world, and maybe you know, so you have to go to war against, and that's that's more calm. Anyway, that's more dangerous. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I brought that up as a, because I had to interrupt myself, really, because I was actually making a different point. But, I mean, I think there are ways to trust what we know and without becoming shackled to belief. But I think that really does entail a development of some kind of wisdom through experience, and that's very rare. And, of course, one doesn't want to necessarily claim to having it, but you know, privately one can sort of have that sense or not. But what we're talking about here is much more what I was referring to with all these millions of people who believe that the world's run by Illuminati, you know, Satanists, that's just belief. That's just something they believe, and they've been conditioned to believe that, in fact.
I think there's evidence that the world is run by a small elite, that, and I think, you know, you can trace even the history of that, and you can trace them. You can trace the how those groups have formed and the kinds of actions they've combined.
I agree, I absolutely agree. But I'm just saying that
I think you can see evidence of that.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not enough to reduce it to a simple online belief. That's what I'm saying.
Well, to believe in a club called the Illuminati that people join and then they, you know, wear masks and go to balls and that sort of stuff. You know, I mean, some people are obviously probably are doing that.
Yeah.
You know, that people are doing everything.
Yeah.
The world, you'll find. And, you know, we're not going to, since I don't have access to those echelons.
Those parties.
But I've met people that seem to embody those, you know, those ideas. I've met extreme elitists,
for
example, who seem to, you know, who appear to be, you know, similar to Nazis or whatever they would like, you know. You occasionally brush up against these kinds of, and then you're going to go into shock when you do actually meet one.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, but well, are they important? Well, they are, to the extent that they have, if they have all the money and all the power, and they run the politics and so on. I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand, you know.
No, well, I don't dismiss it. But
I can think of some local. You know, a local, anyway, whatever, example of that, which I think is very real, and I think I've come up against it on just in the city that I live in, you know. So I think there is a group, you know, I think I've there's photographs, and there's evidence of their activities and so on. But
yeah,
I mean,
yeah, well, people form groups, of course they do, and you know, people with common interests, basically, and so yeah, of course there's a ruling class. I'm not debating that, just that we can identify who they are and what they look like and what sort of clothes they wear and what they believe, and you know, that whole thing is what I would question. Like, the ruling class could be not completely unknown to us, because some of them seem to be public figures, but in terms of what they actually believe and what they do and what their goals and all the rest of it, that really, you know, we're somewhat, it's what they say about the UFO, like the UFO basically, all of our interpretations and our beliefs about what the UFO is dependent on the evidence that the UFO itself is giving us. So to some extent, that's true of the ruling class, because they're the ruling class. So they control the media, they control everything else by definition. So, you know, and they even control us, because if they get to us young enough, they traumatize us and cause amnesia and all the rest of it. So, yeah.
So you don't believe all that because you think you've witnessed it or you've seen it. It has operated in your own life. You need to believe that.
Well, but I'm saying there's a contradiction in even that. I'm saying I believe that, but I'm also saying I'm recognizing that I only believe that because I've been conditioned to believe it. So I can't really believe it, not 100%. I just know something's happened, and that, yeah, there's a ruling class, and they do things to maintain their rule, and apparently, yeah, all of this stuff is part of it. But you know, when The Godfather came out, Mario Puzo book, people thought that it was about the mafia. I mean, it was, but they thought it was a more or less realistic portrait of the mafia. The Godfather movie came out, same. Turned out that Puzo had just made it all up. He didn't really know anything about the mafia, but actual, you know, the mafia themselves saw The Godfather and they thought it was awesome and they started imitating, you know, the way that they thought the mafia should act, right? So at least, I mean, that's what I've heard, whether that's true or not. So something similar could be going on with the elite, you know, that all these narratives are being created about them and then they start to go along with that and say, oh, that's how the elite is supposed to act, or at least that's how, you know, people expect us to act, so we can go along with that. And you know, the satanic rituals, as we've talked about before, how much of that is theater anyway, just geared towards the subjects of it to frighten them and to imprint them with memories. We're always kind of dealing with a fabricated version of reality when we're talking about, you know, the culture.
Yeah, I guess it seems a bit fanciful to me to just, well, I wouldn't come down completely on the side of that being called true, but, you know, it's partly true, I think. I mean, I think things are going on, unimaginable things are going on, and imaginable, and, you know, it's all a mix, but anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But
when people tell me, you know, the Jesuits are running the world and so on, I have a hard time with that, partly that I don't really know any Jesuits, even though they're around here, you know, Anyway, I don't really meet many Jesuits, but I guess if I did, I'd begin to imagine that, whatever, I'd be able to imagine it better. But conspiracy. Anyway.
Well, I mean, it makes sense if there's a ruling class that they keep a finger in all the pies. So there's all these little secret societies that come into existence, but the ruling class is there ruling, and so they have their intelligence services that monitor these groups and even create them, and then they infiltrate them if they have to, or if they create them they don't have to, if you see what I mean. So the ruling class would be Jesuits, they would be Masons, they would be movie stars, they would be CIA, there'd be all of these things and none of them.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's true. I think it's true that that's kind of how things work. I think things are hierarchical. I don't see how they can be otherwise, because just the nature of human, you know, the world, and you're born as a baby, you get older, you're nothing, you move up a ladder, and some people systematize that, and they turn that into, they create societies around that. Some people are very, very fixed on the idea of power, which is something that I don't share that fixation, I don't think that's the purpose of life, but some people obviously do, and they've done a, they've created culture around that, you know, and a lot of cultures based on that. So, definitely exists. When I was in my little brief stint in journalism, I definitely encountered a cabal. I was tricked into going to a meeting one time, and I realized it was not a dinner, it was a meeting, and then I was going to have to sit there all night and listen to these people tell me their plans for how we as journalists could rise, you know, and gain power in Canada. And just put me to sleep. I mean, but I didn't want to be there. So I found a way to leave. Well, I just walked out, basically, but that didn't help my career at all, I can tell you. And I know for a fact that I was, number one, I was tricked. I wasn't told I thought I was going to a dinner. I didn't know who would be there. I met all the people that went on to essentially have the careers. You know, they already had them, but they remained in their positions, and it was very, you know, it was blatant that that's what it was. And so, you know, that's just an example, and very, you know, in one city, once kind of a small town situation. But I know that across Canada, that happened. It was the truth. It was how they ran it. That's why we have such a dead, our journalism is dead in Canada, because that's who runs it, you know.
And how do you think that you managed to get an invitation to that meeting?
How did I get an invitation? Because someone, the person giving the, she called it the dinner party, she had a soft spot for me and was trying to promote my, in her own strange way, she was trying to promote my career and felt that she could benefit. She had been using me in a certain way because, anyway, it's a long story, but I was actually helping her in some ways be successful, although I wasn't really aware that I was doing that. And so she wanted to do something for me. I didn't want any part of it, though, you know? So it was kind of it was a little bit of a difficult situation. All I can say is I had no trouble walking out of it because of who I am or whatever. That some people would have sat there, you know, different, suffering or deciding they must join this. And I mean, I didn't. I just said, get me out of here. And one of the things that happened to me during that, I was there for an hour or two, before I finally got out, that was that I felt myself sinking into a almost coma of boredom, but also it felt like a trance. And really, I was fighting to stay awake. And as I walked away, that lifted. I mean, I feel that hypnosis was, in some form of hypnosis, was, you know, was operating on these people, and that was part of it, you know. And the room, I mean, just the atmosphere in the room. And so whenever I sense that same energy, I remove myself from any situation that has that kind of energy in it. I think that, well, you lose on some level. I mean, I didn't have a career, but I gained on another level, you know. I mean, I've never been tied up to the, you know, to the extent that some people will spend their whole lives working for a boss, you know, working for essentially like Leonard, who I think, you know, was deeply bored in many ways with his life and who he was, but he soldiered on because he didn't see another way. I think that's, you know, that's a certain level. We should maybe work on trying to get rid of that. No.
Yeah. So were you aware at the time that you were making that choice? I mean, obviously you were aware that you were choosing to leave the room, but were you aware that if you stayed, that your career would be made, and leaving meant the opposite?
Yeah. I sort of felt that this is not going to be good for me, you know, these people are not going to like this. And I was processing that during the meeting. I was kind of thinking, but I didn't like any of them either. You know, I mean, one of them was my editor, who I did like, actually. But, you know, he continued, he was a fairly decent person. And he did for a few years. He continued giving me work and so on. Actually, he helped me. So it wasn't 100% of a, you know. Not everyone in that room was as controlled as some of the people who were leading it. But really, I mean, if you look in their eyes and see this kind of glazed. Really, there were people there that I wouldn't associate with, you know, in life, in my normal. I would the kind of people I would just not want to be too close to. Yeah. And I would even suspect some mind, you know, there was some mind control operating, deep mind control. So, you know, I tend to believe then the theory that this was a little bit of an example of how when the CIA took over the media, you know, and they eliminate all the people that don't cooperate with them, that this room that I was in with and these people were in many ways products of that, you know, decision that was made at a high level years before, and everyone was part of it. It was fulfilling their little role in that design, you know, but That's why when I turn on the media, I get that feeling often, you know, of just comatose, you know, boredom and sometimes I want to scream at them. But I just think that's, you know, all of this is a plan and it's all, I do believe that. I do believe there's been, to a great extent, they've taken over culture, they've automated it almost, they've made it into something that was never intended to be. It's become like a pseudo-culture.
Well, that's kind of optimistic in a way, because at least it allows for the possibility of a real culture. Which I don't disallow it, but I haven't seen any evidence. I'm not sure if this is it more intuitive but than evidence-based, but intuitively, I guess because I was born into a culture that was so obviously, toxic, my sense is that culture itself is toxic, rather than that we just ended up in a particularly bad one.
I think it might be. I think anyway, we're certainly finishing it off now. I don't know that it's really hard to feel optimism, you know.
Yeah, it really is.
This is a distraction. Maybe that's, you know, very quickly things can change.
Well, I think it has to do with complexification. The more a culture advances, the more complex it becomes, and the more complex it becomes, the more destructive, the more restrictive, because it's fragmenting. I see it in the analogy of a body that's decaying. So culture is something that is not really alive in itself. I mean, the biological culture is something that lives off something else. So I think there's something there that we've somehow let ourselves be weaned off the life force itself and weaned onto a bottle of toxic, you know, LSD-laced goat's milk.
Right. Which seemed like fun at the time. when LSD first came out, it did seem like it was fun. But I think now the best, I personally, and I might be wrong, but I think the best expression on the planet right now of human spirit or whatever, it's really in conspiracy, what you call conspiracy culture, but I just think it's the people relearning, you know, using the tools we have now on the internet to come up with this analytic, you know, more picture of the last 50 years. I mean, I'm not a great whatever. I'm not deeply cultured. I'm not a great thinker or intellectual. I don't know that much, but I know a little bit, and I'm grateful to have this period of my life now where I can actually look back and understand what I've been through in this lifetime. And we have the tools now to do that, and I think there's a lot of creative energy in that. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps me watching it. But, you know, whereas I think people that are involved in the official culture that I see around me in Canada, and it's pretty pathetic in many ways, I think they're just doing finger exercise, you know, finger painting. Mm-hmm. They're writing poems, and they're, whatever they're doing, they're entering contests, they're being on CBC and all that. I find it, most of it, just totally uninteresting.
Yeah.
What, you know, animates this stuff. But I guess it's also, I'm an old lady now, so that's how we get to feel.
Well, I mean, your point is inarguable, I think. It's like if your house is burning down, you don't wash the dishes, you know. You don't start repainting, touching up paint jobs in the living room, right? You just figure out how to get out of the burning house, so, or how to put out the fire, whatever. But, yeah, so the context of what we're discovering and what we always knew about culture, the conspiratorial underbelly of it, once you start to see it, it does make any other focus kind of absurd. Like, why would you possibly want to investigate anything else besides the true nature of, you know, our social reality? That's my point of view. Obviously, not everyone agrees, but pretty much everyone I talk to does.
Well, it's similar to what we thought the counterculture was, you know, back in the 60s. We thought that was a great, you know, it was a big train we were getting on, or, you know, or something that was going on that was beyond our control, that was going to be, you know, it was entertaining, it was all these different things, it was hard to fathom and so on. But I think now we're in something similar, you know, but it's just a different phase, and we're taking apart things instead of just jumping on the bandwagon. But I just, that's my generation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My generation didn't get to where I am. They're just in retirement now. But I feel very excited, you know.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I mean, to be excited.
I don't know why I would, but I do. I, you know, yeah. Oh, yeah. I even have a painting I bought. I'm just looking at it now from a friend. She's an Egyptian painter. Now she's famous in Egypt. When I bought this, she could barely survive, you know. And I would buy a drawing from her just so she could go and have dinner. Anyway, I have it on my wall now, and it's of a burning, sinking ship. And then there's this figure in the foreground that has antlers and white, looks sort of semi-human. It's watching, or trying to run out. I don't know. Is watching this ship burn and sink into the sea, and this is like, you know, emblematic. Like it's my favorite. The only piece of art maybe I have at this point. I've never had much, but you know, I've always been a fan of this sinking ship, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've always been. I think I've been waiting for this all my life.
The ship to sink.
Yeah.
Feel like I have too. It's part of why I don't believe it when it looks like it's happening, because I don't trust myself to not just, you know, see that because I want to see it.
Well, something will come out of it, you know. I mean, I'm sure something, but we can't see what it will be. We can't see what it is right now.
Mm.
But something is going to come from the ashes.